time.
Okay, we are recording.
Okay, well, let's call this meeting to order. Thank you all so very much for being here. We are, I guess, going to just dive right into the agenda unless Mr. Executive Director, you have anything you want to say. Okay, perfect. Are there any agenda modifications?
None that I'm aware of.
Okay. Are there any public comment from anyone? Seeing none, do I have a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting in November?
I motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. All right. Show the minutes as approved. We'll move straight into the audit presentation discussion. Mr. Executive Director?
Actually, this is Allison Harrell. She's partner on the audit, and she'll make her presentation.
Perfect. Welcome. You got the floor.
All right. Good afternoon. Like Ron said, I'm the audit partner over this engagement, and I'm here to deliver good results. So we always like to get good news. I will start with the report to the audit committee, which is a report that looks about two columns halfway down the first page. This is a lot of boilerplate language that fulfill our requirements under auditing standards. Does anybody have this report?
I think it's exhibit B or C.
C. But like I stated, this is a lot of boilerplate language that just gives our required communications to the audit committee that we performed our audit in accordance with generally accepted auditing procedures as well as government auditing standards. We've described those to you in our engagement letter dated July 18, 2016. We've discussed with certain members of this committee as well as management our independence, our open two-way communication, and other scope matters for the audit. There were no new accounting policies this year, thankfully, since we had the big one last year. Thankfully, that affected the authority's financial statements, so we did not have any changes in disclosures or anything that needed to be adopted, as well as there were no changes in accounting policies at the authority level. There were no significant or unusual transactions that we felt we needed to bring to the committee's attention. And of course, there are always accounting estimates that are part of financial statements. We look at those estimates during our audit process and determine if they're reasonable. We have no items to report there. Some of the estimates on your financial statements are listed here, and they are the allowance for uncollectible accounts, then of course your infamous pension liability from last year that was implemented, that is quite a few different line items on your financial statements. And then the allocation of certain expenses and fees across your functions. You do have still some amortization of some capitalized fees, and then also the useful lives used to determine the depreciation on your capital assets. So those are the main significant estimates that are for your financial statements. There were a couple of audit adjustments that were proposed by us and recorded by the authority. You'll see them on Exhibit A. Mainly, they are all the pension liability. So, and that is because the FRS delivers the information. It was late February this year. It's getting a little bit earlier. With each passing year, as the standard has been implemented. So this is a calculation that is based upon reports that the FRS releases and also is based upon a lot of formulas. So I'm not going to get into too much detail on the journal entry, but those were all the journal entries. So it's really a true testament to Christy and also Ron as far as the accounting records go, that we're not having to come in and clean up anything for the audit. This was something that we expect every year. So the numbers that you are looking at during the year are accurate, and you can rely on that information to make any kind of financial decisions at the board level. There was an uncorrected misstatement. It is due to the utilities expense just because of the cutoff of when the bill is received and when the bill is paid. There's 12 months of utilities expenses within your financial statements. However, if the month of September this year was less or greater than September in the previous year. We have a difference there. We've just been carrying it forward, so that is your only uncorrected misstatement. It's just it's really just due to a timing difference there. We encountered no disagreements with management. We're not aware of any consultations that management had with any other accountants regarding accounting or auditing matters, and there were no significant issues that arose during the audit. We did not encounter any significant difficulties, and we do have a letter on internal control over financial reporting. If we had any internal control deficiencies, we would have noted those there. There are none. So we have no items to report to you there. And then once this report is issued, Exhibit B will be a copy of a representation letter that is signed by management as well as Christy, stating that they've given us everything we asked for during the audit and making certain representations about account balances during the year. That is the report to the audit committee and our required communications. I'd be happy to take any questions. Really, it's a very good report. So.
Yes, please.
Call your attention to page 37. There are some matters mentioned there of instances in which we failed to support some of the invoices paid with proper documentation, and also separate instances noted where the rate per the invoice did not match contract due date.
Page 45 of 89.
45 of 89 in your packet, 37 of the financial CPA's report.
Okay.
So my opinion would be that this is language that was inadvertently held over from the prior audit and not something that was identified in this audit. I'd hate to think that we had a repeat or a recurring deficiency.
No, you are correct. That was inadvertently rolled over from the prior year. And then as well, I was going to get to that on the financial statement package, but then on the previous page 36, the prior audit findings, we will say there on that last sentence in that paragraph that corrective actions were taken to address the findings made in the prior year. Or really the other matters noted in the prior year.
So then you'll send us out another letter that's not say draft on it.
Yes, in the final version it'll be gone and that language will be replaced.
Why don't we have a final version before we meet to get your report out? I'm not used to doing that.
We have, in the past with this committee, sometimes have had some adjustments, not necessarily number adjustments, but because there's so much narrative in your financial statement footnotes, there has been some slight changes there. So we've issued them in draft form until they're approved by this committee, and then we're ready to go final.
Sure.
The board,
but
the
you're going to finalize something that we're not going to say. I mean, we need
the board will see it.
The full board will see it. Yeah. After it's finalized.
Okay. Yes, and the executive committee will get it as well. So you're there to tell them we approve it subject to these final changes.
And yes, and like I said, there has been some slight changes on some of the narrative and the footnotes because of all the buildings and leases and things like that. So, been a few changes. I will move over to the financial statement presentation. So starting with my page one, which I'm not sure which page in your packet it is. Let's see.
Sit there. Did your report? Yes. It's page 6 of 89.
Okay. So page one is our opinion, and we have issued an unmodified opinion on the financial statements, which is the highest level of assurance we can give on a set of audited financial statements, so a great clean opinion, no issues noted there.
I'm sorry, are you on 6 of 43?
6 of 89, sorry.
I'm ahead of that, so yeah, this is...
Okay. Oh, did the number differently?
Yeah, the number
So what's at the top of your page?
This is the
I'm sorry. The top right, the way
three,
all of our...
3 of 43.
The way all of our agenda packets work is the top right is the number of the exhibit. So our attachment, attachment B is 3 of 43.
Okay.
And then the whole packet is numbered at the bottom for every page, so...
That doesn't print.
No, is that what it is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. We'll have to work on the margin.
Move the margin up a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go with page 3 of 43.
Attachment B, 3 of 43.
Yes. So this is our unmodified opinion. Great, clean opinion. Your opinion does have a couple of additional paragraphs just due to additional schedules that are required by governmental auditing standards, as well as the management's discussion and analysis, which begins on page 4, which is your...
6 of 43.
6 of 43. This was prepared by Ron, and we do not audit this section of the report. However, we do look at this section to make sure that the numbers agree to all of the numbers in the audited financial statements and recalculate some of the amounts and make sure that everything is not contradictory to information we obtained during the audit. I will not be going over this information in detail, but if Ron would like to add any comments about that.
So in terms of the financial highlights, the only two real major things that happened were the sale of the Danfoss building that they were previously leasing under our agreement with the city. In that, and you'll see it reflected in the statements, we received $79,000 in proceeds from that transaction. And then in March, we were awarded the $20,000 grant from the Knight Foundation when we took over the EEP program from the EDC, as well as $4,000 that we got directly from the EDC. In terms of the major activity or changes, just the attempt here is just to try to explain some of the changes that happened year over year. So since they're comparative financial statements, we showed the 3 years of activity, but the changes for the prior two. And the maybe the things to really point out when you're trying to read these financial statements, understand that, you know, depreciation is obviously a big chunk of the bottom line in the change in our net position. So keep that in mind from a cash flow standpoint, that those that number does not impact cash flow. And then, you know, we've had some bad debts in the past couple of years related to BEC Technologies and as well as Bing. Those numbers are actually reflected in operating expenses, and that information is listed in that paragraph there. I'm not going to read all of that for you, but if anyone has any questions as they look at these financial statements, I'd be happy to try to answer them for you, particularly related to this, the summary of the changes. So.
Any questions?
And then moving on to your basic financial statements, which are page 10 of 43, I believe, if I calculated correctly.
Yes.
Okay, good. I can count. Which is a good trait for me.
Yeah.
CPA to have. It starts with your statements of net position, and everything's fairly consistent with the prior year as far as your total current assets comparatively, $4.1 million to $4.2 million. The primary difference in your capital assets is really your depreciation, the decrease from $4.5 million to $4.2 million. And as I stated before, you will see a few lines on your statement of net position here regarding the pension liability, which was the standard that was implemented last year for the FRS plan and the employees that are participating in that plan of the authority. So you'll see you have a deferred outflow of resources as well as a deferred inflow of resources as well as a net pension liability. On your total net position, the decrease again primarily due to depreciation is from $8.6 million to $8.4 million. You do still have almost $4.2 million in unrestricted net assets. So those unrestricted net assets are primarily liquid as you have cash and cash equivalents and then designated cash and cash equivalents of a little over $4 million. So great ending to the fiscal year and a good financial position. On the following page is your income statement or your statements of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position. Here you do have an operating loss of $351,000 as well as an overall loss of $234,000. Again, a lot of that is due to your depreciation. You'll see your depreciation and amortization expense here of $297,000. So that's $300,000 of your operating loss for the year. Last year, you had a lease termination fee of $100,000 that you did not have this year, so your operating expenses decreased from $1 million to a little over $1 million, as well as some of your total operating revenues decreased due to some of the changes in the leases from $729,000 to $696,000 in the current year.
That, for those that weren't around, that $100,000 lease termination fee was related to Lot 1E that we purchased back from Avalanche. Avalanche had purchased the future leasehold interest through 2074, so they didn't want it any longer, and so we bought it back from them. That was the appraised value.
For $1 a year. That's all they were getting?
I'm sorry?
Were they only getting $1 a year from...
No, it was basically, this is Lot 1E.
Oh.
This was Avalanche, so right behind the Florida Virtual Campus, they had acquired that, thinking they were going to expand that facility, and Chip Hartung, who was the principal in that, decided they weren't going to do that. So he basically sold the leasehold interest back to us for the $100,000.
And I think we ended up with a profit on that, didn't we?
Yes. It was, I think you paid $65,000 an acre, and we sold it for, $47,000 an acre. It's 2.4 acres, I think. Just the change in the market, you know, from when they did it, I think it was like 2006 or 7. So, timing.
And then you also this year have, as you mentioned before in your management's discussion analysis, you've got the gain on the sale of assets this year of $71,000 related to the Danfoss building.
And that's different than the number on the front page of the $79,000. Yeah. $79,000 was the proceeds. There were some expenses that offset that, and the balance of some unamortized capital expenses from the original lease that were offset.
Correct. And we do still, on this statement, say the net position at beginning of year as restated. The only one that was restated is in the 2015 column, just due to the implementation of the pension standard last year. So that will go away with your statements next year. On the following page, you've got your statements of cash flows, which converts your income statement basically to a cash basis. You can see where your cash was used in operating activities of approximately $40,000 and used in capital and other capital activities of $2,000, but you had investing activities, which included the proceeds from that sale, as well as your interest and dividends on your investments, providing you with $124,000 of cash, for a net increase to your cash balances of $82,000 compared to the $168,000 decrease last year, which a lot of that had to do with the lease termination fee, as Ron mentioned.
So basically, without the Danfoss deal, we're looking at a cash change of about $3,000, or basically break even cash.
Beginning on the next page are starting your notes to the financial statements, which, you know, we thought they were going to decrease, and they have decreased over the years as far as the narrative on the buildings and leases and everything. However, we had to add 6 pages of pension disclosures last year, so we're still at a pretty lengthy notes to your financial statements. But as I stated before, there have been no new pronouncements or no new policies adopted, so most of the financial statement footnotes are consistent with the prior year, updated for current year information. And then also we were able to get rid of some of the buildings and some of the restructuring footnotes that were still in there from the prior year, since we had comparative statements last year of 15 and 14, and the restructuring occurred in 2014. So note one describes your accounting policies. Note two discusses the ground lease, which has not changed except for the 2014 restructuring, which amended it. Note 3 is the infamous retirement plan footnote that keeps going.
And going.
Allison, do you expect that to get any less onerous than it has been the last 2 years?
I do not. No, it will not change. I expect that the state of Florida will be more timely with the distribution of their reports because they have now, for the second year in a row, held up quite a few audit reports. So, but as far as the length of the disclosures, that will not change. The calculation has gotten easier as far as the Florida retirement system has made their templates more user-friendly, and we've been able to more easily calculate those numbers. But no, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
So just to understand that, I'm sorry, I'm not that familiar with FRS and the changes that have been made recently. So the employee is required to contribute 3%, and in addition, the employer contributes 21.14 if it, for senior managers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? So for a total of 24% of their salary going to retirement.
We do not have anyone classified as senior management.
Okay.
I'm actually classified as regular class employee.
All the employees are classified as regular class.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Yes, and there's a couple different, of course, options with FRS. You've got the defined benefit versus the defined contribution, and we do have disclosures regarding the choices there, as well as participating in drop that's optional. So it does continue on for quite a few pages.
And if you want her to explain what all this means, she'd be happy to. Don't ask me. Well, I mean, just big picture, though. I mean, the purpose of this.
Big picture, it really was not meant for governments, the authority says. It was meant for local governments, counties, cities, universities that participate in the Florida retirement system. They, as you know, we had quite a bit of the state's workforce that went into the DROP program, and then subsequently changes in the DROP program were made. These local governments were not reporting the liabilities on their financial statements, but then once they had a lot of retirees, they were faced with a large payout to the FRS system for the obligation that they owed in for the retirements. So it was really meant for these larger governments, and you'll see some of these governments had adjustments of upwards of $100 million to record these pension liabilities on their books. And a lot of it relates to law enforcement, because you can see from the rates that law enforcement is also paid at a special rate and things like that. So if you have policemen and the police force that are retiring, and you have governments that were not able to, they did not have the cash flow to meet the obligations into the Florida retirement system. You have larger states out there that were faced with more serious problems than the state of Florida, because you've got, differences in the investments in their retirement systems and how their retirement systems operate. So the state of Florida is not in a bad position, but the Governmental Accounting Standards Board wanted to make sure that the local governments had these obligations and liabilities on their books when they are faced with a large retirement. So that's really the big picture of why this came to be. I think that local governments, like the authority size, we're just a byproduct, and you have to post it because you are a governmental entity that has to, go by governmental accounting standards. But as you can see, the amount, $70,000, $80,000, is material to an entity your size. But overall, it was meant for these local governments to make sure that they are posting these liabilities.
Allison, I know in the banking industry there was a lot of regulations written that very small banks could exclude themselves from certain regulations. Do you anticipate organizations 10, 12, 5 employees maybe getting any relief from this?
That would be nice. I have not heard anything on the national level that's coming down the pipeline. To give you an idea of how complex the governmental accounting world has become, since 2000, They ended with GASB 34, statement number 34. We are now in the 80s. So we have continued to just issue 5 to 7 statements a year. So instead of simplifying things and giving exemptions, they seem to keep making things overly complex. So I'm not sure that would be something that they may consider in the future, but I have not heard anything.
And is that federal or state?
Well, this is a governmental accounting standards board. So this is, it's not a federal entity, but it is nationwide. So it has nothing to do with the state of Florida. The state of Florida, I guess, potentially could pass a statute exempting smaller governments from this accounting standard, which some states have passed similar statutes to that, exempting some organizations from other accounting standards, but I haven't heard anything about that either.
Okay.
Be a good suggestion, though.
Common sense.
Yeah.
You can provide us with which states have successfully weighed that, couldn't you?
There has been no state that has exempted this. To my knowledge. Now, other states, because there are some just strange accounting standards out there, so other states have exempted some entities from either reporting under governmental accounting and given them an option to report under financial accounting standards, which would exempt you from this pension liability. But, and nothing so far that would exempt any state or agency from this. But I like your thought process. Continuing on through the notes, you've got your commitments and contingencies regarding the master plan update and the costs there, which are being amortized over a period of 10 years. You also have a disclosure regarding the Danfoss building and recognizing the gain of $71,000 this year. And some other details regarding the lease or the tenants in common for the Danfoss building. Again, not a whole lot of changes here except for the sale of the Danfoss building and the gain.
So this note really describes what the structure of this whole arrangement that we had with Danfoss prior to the sale, and that will stay on there until after next year's, well, this year's statements, right? Because the transaction was for 15-16, so it'll be on next year's as well.
16-17.
Right, it'll be on year 16-17, and then it'll come off when you're comparative of 17-18.
Yeah.
Continuing on through this note, discusses the City of Tallahassee ground lease, and then some of that is to do with the Danfoss and termination of the ground lease with Danfoss. And then also with the Sunnyland Solar ground lease and the escrowed funds that are still held. Sorry, lost my place here. Okay, the escrowed funds that are still held on the Sunnyland Solar ground lease. So this year you didn't expend any, whereas $35,000 was spent in the previous year. Note 5. Discusses a lot of your operating leases on the buildings that are still operated by the authority. This note has significantly gone down in size in the last few years since the restructuring. On the bottom of page 28, which I'm not sure is page 30 or 43 for you, that's your future minimum rentals for all of the buildings. So you'll see some of the leases are coming up for expiration in 2018 and then also in 2019. And so you've got $482,000 of minimum lease rental income next year, which decreases to $431,000 and then continues. And you've got a couple of escalation clauses that come into effect in 2020 and 21.
In the Morgan and this building, the Edmonds Center, those are all year-to-year leases. That's why you don't see those continuing. But and we have been renewing those on a regular basis. But.
Right. You can see from your income statement that you're collecting more than $482,000, and some of that has to do with your year-to-year leases and not being recorded here because they're not considered a commitment under accounting standards. On the last page of your financial statement footnotes details the capital asset activity. There was not a lot of activity here as far as additions. You had the deletions, which were for the Danfoss building, and you had some slight additions of $2,000.
You're looking at the addition right here.
It's this laptop.
I was like, get some slight additions of $2,000. Not compared to the activity that we've had in the previous years.
In the past, most of our additions have been related to HVAC equipment as we're going through that process of updating stuff, but we, again, not on everything, pretty fortunate lately.
Right. And then we're also disclosing the $1.4 million that's on the face of your financial statements that's been designated by the Board of Governors for future capital projects. And then also disclosing that you have purchased commercial insurance to mitigate a lot of the risks associated with the authority. You do have, again, the pension standard comes back. Required supplemental schedules for the pension liability. These schedules will continue to grow. As you can see at the top of this first schedule, it says the last 10 fiscal years, although there's only three presented, and that's because of the implementation of the standard. So this schedule will continue to build and accumulate until you have 10 fiscal years to present.
Big page or really small print?
Yeah. We'll turn it once it gets to 10 years. We'll flip it to landscape. So you have quite a few schedules here regarding the retirement plan and then also the health insurance subsidy program, which is also a part of the Florida retirement system and part of the payments that the authority is making.
So not only do they make you do it once, they make you do the same thing twice for two different plans that are really not optional.
No. Yeah. So, and then they make you add all these schedules to your financial statements as well as 8 pages of financial statement footnotes. Again, not meant for governments, the authority size, but nevertheless, we have to calculate it and implement it.
This is for the CPA retirement plan?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. You will never be out of a job. And then the last report, again, is the report on internal control over financial reporting on compliance. This is a required report under governmental auditing standards. If we had any matters that we needed to note to you as far as internal control deficiencies, these would be in this letter. We did not have any during the current year, so again, a great, clean audit. And then, as Mr. Ramsey alluded, we will change some of the information in the management letter. This letter is required by the State of Florida Auditor General to be included in your financial statement package and has some required language there as far as the rules of the Auditor General, so maintaining compliance with those rules as well as governmental accounting standards. So I will change that language so that it's not carrying over from the prior year before we issue final and before distribution to the board. So a great, clean report. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
The rest of item number 5, B through E, those are straight from the charter for the audit committee. So I went ahead and listed those. Those are things that the audit committee is supposed to consider as part of this process. I think she has addressed basically all of those things in her reports. But just so that you know, those are the items that are there.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a comment to staff and Ron and the team. I think it speaks to the good work that you all have been doing. Thank you to you for your work and doing this through the paperwork. But yeah, Ron, just great.
Thank you.
Great job.
Of course, doing a great job for us, as usual, and their team. And
some, some of you may not remember, but and weren't on board, there was a day in which we had, I think, 5 typewritten pages of deficiencies. And which our current CPA partner was the one who uncovered.
Yeah.
And from going down to nothing to report, from five continuous single-spaced lines of problems, I compliment our staff and I compliment TriCorps staff. Both have done an exceptional job, I think, of keeping us proud of who we are and what we do.
Mm-hmm. All right, if there are no questions or comments, I think we are supposed to make a recommendation back to the board. So, if anyone has a motion,
do we accept the offer?
Motion on the floor.
With one addition, friendly addition or amendment, would be with the recommended changes cited.
As amended.
Mm-hmm.
I can't vote, so I can't move.
All right, so movement, is that a friendly amendment to your motion? I think it is.
That's fine.
We have a second.
Second.
Okay, motion and second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Recommendation passes. Fantastic. We'll move on to the RFP.
You can stay if you want.
She's had her fun. She's got mistake from this one.
Yeah.
Okay,
no, you can stay. No. I mean, if you want to learn more about the RFP that's coming out.
Well, sure, it'll avoid me asking questions, I guess.
You certainly want me to stay.
Okay, I'll stay.
Okay. So, we were directed, I can't recall if it was the board or the audit committee that directed us to go ahead and do an RFP, since it's been a while. So, the Florida statute requires that we follow a particular audit selection procedure, which I gave to you at the last meeting. They included it in this meeting, and the requirements are also contained within the RFP. So, the 36-page RFP, I'm sure, was exciting reading. I will tell you that I did not start from scratch. I started with a template provided by Leon County government and the one that they used, and I whittled it down as much as I could, considering the size of the Leon County audit versus our audit. So there's a lot of information in there that a lot of it's just background information so that the folks that are responding to the RFP know what they're getting into. That's what we're trying to do. So you can see there's several pages just describing us, the type of services that are done. We do have a proposed schedule. So let me go to that. It's probably a good place to start. And if anyone has had any questions as I'm going through this, please stop me. So the basic calendar that we're looking at is to issue the RFP on May 1st, provide for 22 days, we'll probably advertise it a couple of times, get notification of interest from the people who are interested a couple of days before we have a pre-proposal conference on May 24th, and then have a deadline for questions, which is about a week after that. Get responses to the RFPs by June 5th, which is over a month, which is a pretty good period of time for most RFPs. Our policy requires that they be posted for 20 days. I'm sorry, that was the response to questions was June 1st, and the due date June 12th, so more than a month. A lot of it, too, I took into consideration the fact we have holidays and Memorial Days around there, so we kind of have to play that game as well. And then, up until that point, there's no work for the audit committee to do. Once we get the responses back on June 12th, then we will distribute those to the audit committee. They will, if there are more than three responses, then we have the option of having a preliminary meeting, which could be used to narrow down the number of folks that we want to actually make presentations, in which case you could then have the meeting the following week on June 29th. Now, those dates and times of those meetings are subject to change, and obviously we've got to get the people's schedules and try to work that out, but that's about the amount of time we'll need to get those to you and have you evaluate the proposed
Question for you, Ron. For those responses that are determined non-responsive, who will make that determination? Will staff make that determination up front, or will that go?
We'll make our initial assessment to look at them and see what we believe are not responsive, and we will note those to you.
Okay.
But you will ultimately have the decision on what's considered responsive or not.
Okay.
What are we paying now?
$18,500. Half of that goes to the partner and half to the firm.
Is that how it works, Dave?
And then, so there'll be a ranking. Basically, the way the scoring system, it talks about the elements in the back of how to score this thing. Each voting member will rank their top three candidates, and based on, you know, sort of like they do the basketball poll, they'll get 3 points for first place, 2 for second, and 1 for third, and then whoever's got the most points will be the highest ranked.
How long has Thomas F. Ferguson held this country?
Was it 09 when this stuff happened?
Yes, so it was since fiscal year 08.
Wow. Yeah, 9 years, 8 years, I guess.
And how long is this RFP going to be good? How long is this contract?
That's a good question. At the beginning. So, yes, sir.
For the record, in this last year's audit chair, and as a member of the executive committee, we typically do everything for 2 to 3 years. Okay. And then put it out for RFP. We felt for a lot of different valid reasons it was not to our best interest at the time to change auditors during our acquisition, disbursement to the two colleges, or different things coming up. And so we delayed and deferred until 6, 7, 8 years, whatever numbers she came up with, 8 years, 9 years, I believe. But the committee last year recommended that it was probably the proper time to go forward with a new RFP. And for the record, there is absolutely was no adverse issues with the firm we have today. We felt like they were doing an extraordinarily fine job, and we were very pleased with them. But I think it's prudent for us as members of this board to periodically test the market and put that RFP out.
Because I was going to find out if it would be appropriate to make a motion to this committee that they would do it for the same price for another year or for 3 years.
We did that last year.
Okay. We've been doing that.
Yeah. So that obviously is an appropriate thing.
And this is really, I think, just to reiterate what Dave said, this is a public board kind of issue, which is to make sure that you periodically.
Do we have any issue if they bid it and win it for 3 years?
Yeah.
You have the 8 or 9 that they're already in, you have 12, and we don't have to switch firms or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you get to vote on that.
I'll shut up.
And it is a three-year contract. And again, all of this is up to you folks if you decide you want to do something different. But a three-year contract with two-year renewals.
So that's the question. That's because I think the language I have. The question is basically it's 3 years without any affirmative action from the board or from the committee, and then if you want to extend for 2 years, it requires affirmative action. Got it. Okay.
But for calls, it can be broken.
For cause, right?
Yes.
Right.
Cause what?
Right.
Just kidding.
Ron, I have a couple other questions.
Sure.
So from the, for the presentation, you mentioned the presentation, obviously you have a number of folks who apply, they get ranked, you reserve the right to invite those folks for oral presentation. I didn't see though, because I know sometimes in the RFP process, there's actually like a score that is associated with oral presentation. Sometimes one firm is ranked higher than the other, but then the other one has a better presentation, but there's no way to denote that in the actual scoring. So then if you award that to the other firm, it looks like you're paying special treatment or something like that from a public records standpoint without actually having the full information. So I just wanted to bring that up to get your thoughts or the committee's thoughts. And then the other thing is I noticed that there's a local business preference, but no minority or women-owned business preference. and I would like to put it before the committee again to consider potentially asking for preference for minority women-owned businesses as well, potentially.
Okay. In terms of the scoring, I think the thought process is that the quality of the presentation is really not of interest as much as what did you learn in the presentation.
Right.
So the scoring is when you get the presentation, you can rescore your score. It's a new score.
Okay.
Okay. So in a re-ranking at that point.
Got it.
And again, we're not. This is something I actually really like about what I saw that Leon County did, because I hate these arbitrary scoring systems when you aggregate them and then you rank based on an aggregate score. What I like better, because the way you score in your perception of that, whatever
you're
scoring.
I'm a hard scorer, someone else.
Yes, yeah, easy scorer, right. So really what we want to know is, for each member, who are their top three picks?
Right.
That takes that differentiation out. Mm-hmm. And so really at the end of the day, that's what we really want to know is who does each member consider to be their top three? And based on that, we assign values to it and aggregate that.
Right.
And that issue came up in another committee a couple of years ago where someone had such and such score, but when we said who do you like best, it wasn't the top score or the bottom score, whichever way you rank it.
Yeah. So I will be using this on future RFPs for other things, because I just really like the way it is.
Just so okay, because I've never done that before. So essentially you're saying you can score them, hear oral presentations, and then go back and rescore it.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense to me.
I mean, that's what I can.
No, I guess the county, man. You know, we learned some county too. The city, I've never.
Well, I will tell you, the county's. I will admit, the county's process is not exactly like this. Okay.
Right.
In terms of having two meetings, that's something we've done in the past. Just because if you end up with six presentations, you know, that's a lot of presentations. So, their process was one meeting, and everyone. And you do the county work now, don't you? Okay, so the way it was written, every potential or every bidder has to show up to that meeting and be ready to present if called upon. And so you could have six respondents and they do the ranking and decide they want, you know, the first, third, and sixth person to present. They can choose who they want to present. And I believe they would actually do the presentations before they would do the scoring and ranking. But they just based on their reviews of the RFP, each member would decide, you know, who they wanted to present, or they vote on that. It's my best guess based on reading the RFP.
Right. Okay.
Does that process though that I've got in there make sense to do it that way?
That makes sense.
Anybody see a problem with that?
No problem. Well then again. I don't know what the committee's problem is, but that the only other thing was just my. I don't know that we have a policy technically.
We don't, and we also don't have anything on the local business. It was in there. I left it in there. I tried to adapt it the best I could. That is not anything in our policies that require that we have either of those things in there. That is entirely up to you. If you like for me to find some language related to that preference and to provide some bonus points as they did here. I think it was basically 3%, which converted to 3 points and something. I don't recall the exact numbers, but
yeah, I think it's five points in total. And then 3 points if you like meet some of the criteria.
Yes, right. Yeah. So I could come up with something as well if you'd like.
I think if you come up with some criteria and suggest it, I think that would be good.
I'm sure I could find some language.
Yeah.
And again, this will go before the executive committee as well as the board for a final vote. The idea being that you give me as much feedback as possible and we get a good product. Unless you guys just really want to have another meeting to approve it before it goes to exec and the board. Since you'll all be at the board meeting.
The only thing I would question on the small minority business is whether or not you know, different industries have reason to get that certification, because there's a lot of RFPs that they might be eligible for. If you're in construction, for example, that might be a really good thing. Other industries might not bother with that. So is that a huge deal or not? I don't know in this environment, you know, in this
The question
market.
About
about restricting the...
In other words, are there many small minority businesses certified?
No, that's a good question.
CPAs.
Well, we're not eliminating two small minority businesses. They just get some scoring assistance, right?
Right.
Small, right. And it's usually not the end all. I mean, it's not the end all.
Right.
It's just a...
Would you suggest similar to the local departments in terms of scoring?
That's what I've seen and at the city, you know, and obviously where the city and the county are kind of redeveloping their goals as it relates to minority women-owned businesses, but to this point, that's, you know, usually right about 5%, 3% of the score.
So if you include it in the same sentence, comma, you know, local business or whatever minority business, yeah, women-owned business, it seems like it gives it the same level of preference and not, to your point, how many are certified. We're still playing deference to local business, which does make sense. I wouldn't be opposed if we did that.
Yeah, and the question is, in this example with the local business, there's a form you got to fill out, and you got to certify certain things, and we have disclaimers about how much we have to go back and check. And
yeah.
So what I don't know, because I haven't done that before, is what do others have in their policies related to that? How do you, is there a certification that
there
you have
is.
To follow? Is there do they have to be, you know, certified in that in the way that
but,
you
but aren't we just trying to figure out if they are or aren't and not that it excludes?
I think we're trying to give preference to small or give them additional points if they are a certified small minority women-owned or minority business. Is that right?
That practicing in government-related accounting or auditing or
right.
accounting
ideas.
Right. Right. Well, right.
But it sounds like when we get to this evaluation process, when we just kind of throw out the name, seems like it goes out the door.
But we get to, so we are not city or county affiliated, yes, but not, you know what I mean? Like, we can define what that means, right?
Yes.
We get to say what we, like, so we don't have to say you have to have a certificate and you got to have a sticker and a pin. Like, we can say a letter certifying from the business as a part of
the county government, right?
I'm sorry.
Well, I think that gets, as somebody who, as a woman-owned business, I can say that gets really squishy. You know,
really?
What percentage of it is owned? Are you certified? Are you not certified? Are you certified by the state? Are you certified by the county? Are you a joint certification? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you just have to be really clear about what that is, especially since we're not either city or county.
Does the county
to
have
go this route?
Does the county have a certification?
You know, I gave up on women-owned certification years ago because it's a complete pain in the neck, but. You know, that I don't. So I don't know what the situation is currently.
Well, as far as what
you
said,
have Allison, who is a partner, who is a owner of some percent of the accounting firm we have today.
Not only any points.
Huh?
I doubt enough to get any points. So.
I don't know.
We do have 3 out of 9 of our shareholders are female. But
as a percentage.
Yeah, as a percentage.
And that's typically what they're looking for is percentage, and they're looking for, do you actually have operational control mm-hmm. of the company?
Then so, it would be more informational that we're collecting this information should the question come up that, yes, this was how many minority, and based on your own attestation, whatever you really and not give it any points.
Even as you just said, though, but like as you said, you get it's a little squishy when,
yeah.
you know, when you're not clear. I think why don't we just be as clear and as broad as we possibly can be? If you are certified with the state, if you're certified locally,
right.
if you're certified, we can lay it out. And then that way, because I think this
I
one
think
of the
certification
things
is important. If you're going to
sure.
give preference, you should
it's
require
we
certification.
We say that we'll
okay.
take that, you know, we can, we'll
right.
accept, we're a little bit more flexible than
right.
the city or the county is because they have their own policy. I do think maybe this is a good conversation to kind of pick up later, which is what is our policy in this realm that we might be able to talk about. But in general, I think we need to go as broad as possible to say women minority owned business, what is that? Well, there's a lot of ways you can get that definition and then 5 points
yeah.
if you get it or 5 points if you don't.
That's good timing because I'm rewriting our purchasing policy too. So
there
no.
it is.
Yeah, timely.
Okay. Well, I will investigate that and see what I can find out, and I'll present something back to the executive committee. And eventually, when it gets to the board level, it will probably be on consent. But if somebody has an issue with the way it's presented, obviously it can be pulled from consent. In terms of your question about when it gets to the end, well, basically, the way I would see this is that the determination would be made either they qualify or they don't for either preference, in which case every member of the committee would add those points to whatever score they came up with in the rest of the scoring system,
right,
which would then factor into your own ranking.
Okay.
And normally staff is the one who determines based on the criteria whether or not they meet those qualifications. So you don't even write whether you think that they are or not. You basically tell us, yes, they do meet the qualifications for being local or being or the minority owned, and you tack that on, right?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay. Perfect. All right, other questions, comments on the RFP?
I only have one before you get, that I'd like to get some input on. And one is really kind of on this, on the scoring itself, the technical qualifications. And Allison, I don't think it would be wrong for you to participate in this conversation, or at least offer some input. On the technical side, the audit approach in particular, because I don't know how many folks in this room have actually enough audit understanding to answer some of or score some of this. I want to make sure that we're not just putting things in here that, later there's going to have to be some explanation to go along with this. But
right. adequacy of sampling techniques.
Yes, that was one of them that jumped right out in front.
Google.
It's going to be a long meeting.
Adequacy of analytical procedures. Approach to EDP systems. These are things right out of the county RFP, and we have not really addressed a lot of the audit approach within the audit committee in the past. But typically, I don't know how much sampling you actually do in an audit of our size. How much of an issue is that?
We do sampling. As far as the audit approach we use is a risk-based approach. I would venture to say that the majority of the responses that you're going to get to the RFP would be extremely similar. And I don't know that you would need to really delve into any of those individual areas as far as assigning points. As a matter of practice in public entities, I do look at other RFPs and our other proposals that are submitted, and it is very similar language and very similar techniques that are used by CPA firms. Our approach is called a risk-based approach because we do sampling in the beginning of the audit. We test your internal controls. We assign risk to the accounts and the account balances based upon our results of our internal control testing. That is a technique and approach used by a lot of accounting firms. So, again, I don't think you're going to see a lot of significant differences in your responses.
And that's 45 points. I think that's the big thing that I looked at that I had trouble with in asking the audit committee to evaluate is the actual audit approach. But and maybe my recommendation...
That's a lot of...
Well, I think my recommendation would be that we eliminate the specifics of 1 through 5 and leave the 45 points on audit approach, but have we're still going to ask for it, and I think each member would have to evaluate comparing one to the other. If there are no significant differences, then the points awarded should be very much the same. I don't know. I mean, the other option is that we weight it differently.
It seems like the staffing plan part of it is something that is we could fairly evaluate. And then maybe there's another category that is general approach to the audit, including parens, adequacy of sampling technique, blah, 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 just so when we're looking at it, we're making sure that they're hitting on the key things that we would need them to be doing. But as she says, they probably will be roughly similar.
But if they're not?
But But if they're not, at least we go, oh, they don't even mention analytical procedures.
Yeah.
So we'll have a lower score.
Yeah.
Have we adequately disclosed in there that the firm that is proposing engagement has an expertise in governmental accounting?
Yes.
I don't know. It looks to me like it talks about federal or state financial assistance programs having a 10-point. I mean, is that what we consider ourselves?
No, this is on that. There was an earlier portion where I mentioned that we don't actually require that. Those are related to single audits where you're getting government, federal, state grants, for example, where a single audit has to be conducted. I did that in anticipation that we may, in fact, in the future, have those, that sort of funding assistance. For example, when we get an EDA grant, I believe that would be subject to the Federal Single Audit Act.
EDA?
Economic Development Administration, Department of Commerce.
Yes.
Yeah. So
you have to exceed a $750,000 threshold.
And we hope to do that. So again, this is just anticipating that that if we're going to have a contract for 3 years, and we anticipate that there's a possibility we'll have a, you know, such funding requirements in the future, that we have somebody qualified to do that work. It is not part of this contract. It would, and it says in here that it would be something that a separate fee would be negotiated.
You sure don't want to have to hire somebody to do that one thing.
That's what I'm saying. This
needs to be a part of. It needs to be a part of these specs. It needs to be considered.
It is. It is. What's not included is any fee associated with it because we're not doing it. We don't want to pay for something we're not going to have.
Yeah.
So I just provide. I kind of look forward and said this may be something we need to do. So we want to make sure we don't hire someone who's never done, you know, a federal single audit or state single audit. Make sense? And there could be a lot of locals out there, like, I would think.
What about price? I mean, I know we just discussed what.
Yeah, and the price issue is what falls under state statute. Okay, and so there are actually a couple of options related to that. In the audit selection procedures and statute, it says that. And I believe it's an option to include price or not include price in the scoring. Okay, D. Okay. Yes. So it can't be the sole or predominant factor used to evaluate proposals. So basically, the way we have this structured right now is that the price comes in separately. You don't even evaluate on price. You rank them, okay? And then once you rank them and you say, okay, here's 1, 2, and 3, you instruct me to go and negotiate on price as well. But what they're trying to avoid here is that you take the cheapest,
of course, right,
neurosurgeon you can find, you know, and let them operate. So,
right.
The price then becomes a negotiation. But we do have their bid up front as far as what they're saying. But that is subject to negotiation.
That makes sense.
And there may be in that negotiation process, there may be some considerations as to the quality. I mean, there's some provision in the language there, for example. I don't know. I'm not sure at this point in time what that would be, but it's in there. So we would negotiate it. Allison's a tough negotiator, though, I'm telling you, if it comes to that. So that was my primary concern, and actually the local preference as well as the scoring. So I don't know if anyone has any other questions.
The only last thing I was going to flag is if you just wanted to, I don't know if anybody needs a review of like cone of silence, you know, kind of stuff.
Yes. So during a procurement, and we have a pretty good section on that, which basically says once the RFP is issued, none of the proposers can talk to any of you or any of our board members about the RFP. You know, if you go to a party or whatever, you can talk, just don't talk about the RFP. And that basically all communication has to be in written form and come through me. That's in a nutshell. That's pretty standard for
our. And then all of those are published.
Yes. Well, yes. Any actual questions that we issue an addenda, issue an addendum to the RFP, and put that on our website, and everybody has the same answers to all the questions. And again, there's a process at the beginning where we take all the questions and we do the same thing, even in the, from the meeting that's held, the pre-proposal meeting. A lot of this is standard RFP stuff. I mean, we've been doing these for a while. The hard part is the technical side of the audit requirements and being able to score that. And then clearing up your calendar. So, to, you know, if you can put this on your calendar now, the dates I have there, and if it all works for you, that would be helpful.
What's the calendar then?
Yeah, how about republishing that to us in the email?
We can send that out.
It's June or something.
May and June.
It's a long RFP. I wish I had a link to the table of contents. Here we go. Thursday, June 22nd. And Thursday, June 29th. The proposals will be in June 12th, and we'll distribute them shortly after, so you'll have at least 10 days to look at them. And that will be exciting reading, I can assure you.
Well, I'm looking good. For me, the one of those 2 days I have an appointment I cannot miss. I'm going to just reserve the 22nd.
Okay, and we'll tell you what we'll do is we'll send out a doodle poll and just for those dates. Are there anyone else with a time issue at this point?
It would be great if on the 29th it was like an earlier meeting.
Early on the 29th?
Get out of town. But.
So, 9 a.m. meetings? Does that work? No one else has a conflict at this point?
I may have a conflict with the 29th.
With the 29th?
Yeah. Between the 26th and the 4th of July.
Okay.
We need to do the morning. Yeah, what are you saying?
I don't know.
Tell you what,
quick
business at the
breakers. Exactly. I'll meet you there. Yeah.
That's a nice place.
Yeah.
I've
never been actually.
Very nice.
Oh, really?
And I was a little concerned with the holidays and the summer vacations and all that, but unfortunately this is about the best time we can get. What we can do is we can send out a doodle poll for those 2 weeks, okay, and see what we can come up with just for those 2 weeks every day and see if we can find the place where everyone can participate. The challenge we run into is all the dates after that kind of hit based on trying to hit that August 3rd Board of Governors ratification, and prior to that, the July 18th Executive Committee meeting. So everything just sort of backs up from there, and if we don't hit that date.
I think we could probably make it, especially, and I know it's a pain when you fill out the actual doodle form, but when you have earlier times as well this far out, you know, sometimes the earlier times don't work for people, like, unless it's on the calendar,
okay,
you know, a month or two in advance, and then it's
and that's why I'd like to get it done now, so yeah, that you can get it out there. So we'll get the doodle poll out.
Okay.
Yeah, the challenge is the week of the 22nd, I think, is pretty flexible, and because we'll have the proposals on the 12th, so it'll just shorten the amount of time you have to look at the proposals. But you'll at least have one weekend in there, so you know when you have nothing to do on the weekend, you can read those.
Right on top of my list.
You can sit by the pool and read RFP proposals. So, anyway, But other than that, after that, it's just a matter of making sure that the whoever's going to present has adequate time to prepare, you know, for whatever presentation they might want to do. I mean, I don't think they need a lot of time. They've probably done a few of these, but, you know, at least a few days for their scheduling to, you know, make sure they can schedule to be there. Okay. So we'll get that. I'd like to get that resolved quickly so that we can get it in the actual RFP that gets published. But that would be helpful. So we'll get that out tomorrow.
I think the 22nd works, right? It's just the 29th day.
Yeah. So it's so close to the 4th, it's hard.
Yeah, from a doodle standpoint.
So the 20th.
How much time do you need? The only interval do you need between meetings?
I mean, I'd like to give it a week between meetings, if possible. And so that's the only issue, is if you move the 29th up, then we probably need to look at moving the 26th up. So.
Got it.
So please respond to all times, even if you think you're okay on a date. Answer them all, but we've got to figure out how to make it all work. Okay.
Okay. If there's no more discussion, do we need a motion to approve the RFP with the amended changes that were discussed?
Approve for recommendation to the committee.
That's right.
I move we approve the recommendation for committee. Somebody second.
Motion on the floor.
Are we going to see what we're saying is defining these things before we...
I think we're
going
to see it at the next board.
The executive committee will get it. The executive committee will get it, and then we'll go ahead. It will put it on consent for the board. If you have an issue with it, you want to call it at the board meeting, we can do that too.
Okay.
That's what I think we were saying, instead of doing a separate meeting.
Yes.
Just be on the
unless you really want to have another meeting.
No, I want to be again.
Yeah.
I had enough to say grace over those things.
Yes.
Yeah. Is the meeting fee you're going to give up?
All right. Yeah.
We talked about raising that 50%.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Well, lose that pack of cookies and water.
Yeah.
You still have a motion on the floor?
So, second.
Motion and second. Mm-hmm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. Thank you, Mr. ED. Are there any new business? Seeing none, motion to adjourn.
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks, guys.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Good job for your first time, Larry.
Yeah. I wiped off the sweat on my palms.
Let me ask the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
First Thursday, April.